From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, though pregnancy remains safe for the vast majority of women, an unpublished state-sponsored study reveals that the rate of women in California who die due to causes related to pregnancy has actually tripled over the recent decade. We'll look at the reasons why this increase has occurred in the hour ahead, and we'll key in on what needs to be done with your calls, emails, and online comments included in the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. More dangerous to give birth in California than in Bosnia or Kuwait? Well, according to the World Health Organization, that's a fact. And a California task force investigation has concluded that there was a 300% rise in maternity-related deaths between 1996 and 2006. And though pregnancy remains safe for the vast majority of women, the numbers have clearly increased in the overall mortality rate. We're looking at why in this Forum Hour and considering what needs to happen to ensure greater overall safety. With us in studio is Nathaniel Johnson, freelance journalist who wrote an article for California Watch on the recent study suggesting that maternal death rates have tripled through the 10 years that we have data on from 1996 to 2006. And good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. We also have Dr. Elliot Main with us by phone, chief of obstetrics and gynecology at the California Pacific Medical Center, principal investigator for the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. And welcome, Dr. Main.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. And Aaron Coy is joining us as well. He's an associate professor at UCSF, director of the Center for Clinical and Policy Perinatal Research within the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He's in a hotel in Chicago and joins us from the Windy City. And welcome, Aaron Coy.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for having me.
Glad to have you. Let me begin with Nate Johnson, who is here with us in studio this morning. And first of all, I guess at this point it's kind of mysterious as to why these numbers have gone up. A lot of it has to do clearly with risk factors and cesareans, and we'll talk about all that. But from your perspective, it's almost a kind of cover-up.
Well, I don't have the data to say that it's a cover-up, but it's interesting to me that the state has been revising this for so long, and that the state has said this needs to get out there, but it needs more revisions. And it just seems like a long time for it to be there. And I just wanted to make sure that we hold the state's feet to the fire and make sure that this important information gets out.
It's gotten out because of the California Watch investigation.
Right.
Specifically. And what do you attribute the rise in? I mean, it's a tick upward. All of these deaths, of course, are terrible in the way they affect and have impact on individual families and friends and so forth. But largely cesareans, as far as we know?
Well, I think the way that the collaborative is going about this is really a good way to think about it. They're looking at what do we know right now. We're digging into the data. We're trying to figure out what exactly is causing this, and we can address this. But there are some things that we know we can address right now, and we can make improvements on. And one of those things is cesarean sections. I think that most doctors from my research agree that they're slightly more dangerous. And then when you take into account what happens, not just in the cesarean section, you know, the little risk factors of surgery, bleeding, anesthesia, but then on the subsequent pregnancies, you know, what happens on your third or fourth cesarean, things get much more dangerous. And
there's more scarring and all of that.
There's more scarring. And there's the potential for these placental complications where the placenta actually grows into the scar of the old cesarean or covers up the exit, essentially.
But let's talk a bit about, before we talk to the two physicians who are with us this morning, about other risk factors, just as you've been able to determine what they are. And poverty is a big one. And there's a much higher incidence, I mean, extraordinary, dramatic incidence in African-American women.
Yeah, that's really, really disturbing. And it's disturbing to me for two reasons. One is that it's so high, you know, 3 to 4 times as high as white women, Hispanic women. And that doesn't break down along socioeconomic borders.
It's all classes. Yeah.
All classes. Yeah. All, all incomes. So that's very mysterious. And some have speculated that that reflects the stress of racism. Maybe there's something genetic. We don't know. But that's the other thing that really concerns me about this, is that we've known about this for years and years, more than decades. And nobody's really done the research. That seems like a crucial thing to give funding to. And nobody's seen fit to – I mean, there's been some great research on it. But there surely needs to be more.
There's also, I mean, just to cover the risk factors, I mean, the obvious things like high blood pressure and diabetes, but there's an epidemic of obesity in this country, and obesity plays a central role.
Obesity certainly is going to, and the doctors can speak to this as well, is adding some to those numbers. But they think it doesn't completely explain it, that there are some clinical factors as well that can be can be improved, and that will make a big difference.
Let me bring Dr. Elliot Main into this. When we talk about cesareans, Dr. Main, we're talking about more being performed just for the sake of convenience. I mean, one in three surgeries now, as I read, are cesarean births.
Certainly one in three births in the United States and in California are now done by cesarean section. And that is a concern. Is, you know, they're very low risk, but if you do 100,000 more now than we did 15 years ago, that little risk does add up. I would have to say, though, that we don't have a clear evidence that the rise in maternal mortality that we saw in 2005, 2006 particularly is clearly related to cesarean births. There's suspicions. We are just now beginning to do the formal reviews of the medical charts of those years. And so there is certainly work to be done there.
There's a high percentage of increase, though, in cesarean births. And what I meant to say before, and I misspoke, is that it's the single most common surgical procedure in the United States. I mean, it's an epidemic in some people's eyes.
Certainly. And there's some is by choice, but not a lot is pure patient choice at this point. There is certainly good evidence that people would prefer to have a vaginal delivery. Aaron's done some nice research on that as being presented here at our meetings in Chicago that we're both at.
This concern over cesareans perhaps resulting in the kind of medical complications that we heard Nathaniel Johnson speak of, that is particularly as you go into a second or a third cesarean, but also there's this debate that has gone on perennially from my perspective of whether or not more cesareans are being performed because there's more money in performing cesareans.
Absolutely. And you can document that pretty easily. I mean, you make twice the money on a cesarean that you do on a vaginal birth. And I don't think that's driving anybody consciously to say, let's perform this cesarean and make more money. But one doctor that I spoke to pointed out, you know, if it was reversed, if you're losing money on every cesarean that you're performing, things might be a little different.
Or I think, as Dr. Coy says, maybe if you charged higher for vaginal births, perhaps we'd have more vaginal births, Aaron Coy?
Well, I have said that, and I do think that economic incentives play a small role. I don't think that it's actually reimbursements. I don't think that these reimbursements of 20 to 50% higher for cesarean delivery are a big driver. I think it's really about the time costs that providers bear and the downstream medical, legal, either economic and time costs as well, that are much bigger drivers. And there was a really nice study came out about a year ago that demonstrated that states that had caps on medical, legal findings had lower rates of cesarean delivery.
You've talked also about yesterday's cesareans taking. In lay terms, what do you mean by yesterday's cesareans?
So the cesarean that was performed in the first labor, the first pregnancy, then leads to more than 90% of the time to subsequent cesarean deliveries. And it's those subsequent cesarean deliveries, the second, the third pregnancy after the first cesarean, where, as we talked about earlier, you get these placental complications. And the rate of maternal mortality in these settings of placenta accreta, where the placenta is actually growing into the wall of the uterus, is certainly much higher.
And there is a good deal of mythology, is there not, about C-sections that is safer for the mother, safer for the baby, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. In one of the studies we conducted in Chile, the women who stated they would rather have a cesarean delivery firmly believed that they were choosing a cesarean delivery because it was safer for them and safer for their baby. In contrast, the women who preferred a vaginal delivery believed that was safer for the mother and safer for the baby. So it's part of our job as obstetricians and other providers who take care of pregnant women to make sure that they have the right evidence in their hands to help them think about this setting.
And Dr. Main, what about what Nate Johnson said before about really not enough research being done? Where does the research have to be done here?
Well, there's research done on several levels. One is really ferreting out the causes of the maternal mortality. We know the risk factors, and the risk factors have increased, as Nate did point out. But risk factors are only that. We really need to get back down to the level of the cause. Most women have been dying of bleeding or blood clots, or what's new and interesting is underlying cardiovascular disease. That's showing up in California and in other parts of the nation and in England as one of the key drivers. So that provides some opportunity for optimizing your care and your health status before a pregnancy starts, therefore leading to a better outcome at the end of the day.
Nate Johnson, let's get back to the numbers here, because some think that there's better counting methods now. Talk about the checkbox and how that all works.
Right. Yeah, this is important to get to the bottom of. In 2003, California put a checkbox on every single death certificate that said, was this woman pregnant within a year of death? And that was they were able to identify a lot more women. Where otherwise, you know, it was just a code saying, you know, this woman died from cardiac arrest. Well, did that person die from cardiac arrest during a C-section? Did that person die from cardiac arrest, you know, at an old age? And so they were able to identify a lot more pregnancy-related, pregnancy-associated deaths that way. So it's very important here to look at exactly how much of this is better reporting and how much of this is real. And what the doctors that I've talked to have estimated is that about 30% of this rise is due to better collection techniques.
And Dr. Coy, are you one of those doctors who agrees with that?
I would actually defer to Dr. Main, as he knows this data better than I do. But yes, it does seem like that it's a component of it, but not all of it.
Dr. Main?
Sure. This is actually a reason that there's been some caution on these numbers. The rate in California is actually no different than the rate in the United States as a whole, probably because we're at we deliver one out of every seven births in the nation in California. But the rates of maternal mortality in California are roughly similar to that of the U.S., and the U.S. has seen a threefold rise as well. The CDC has been very cautious for the reason for the potential for oversampling or better ascertainment, i.e. capturing more cases. What's different in California, though, is that we were able to double-check our data by looking at every birth in a year and then matching those births to death certificates and then seeing if any of those died. That's an objective. It gets around the checkbox. It gets around all the other new things that have changed on the death certificate per se. And we've seen rises there. So I think there is a rise. There's some debate about whether it's threefold or twofold, but nonetheless, this is an important public health measure, and it indicates that we need more attention to it.
It's also perhaps a bit perplexing to many who think here we are in perhaps one of the most advanced medical stages of civilization, especially in the United States, and medical care being what it is, not universal yet, but certainly high cost and all the technology we have, and worsening trends in maternity-related death. It does seem puzzling.
Well, exactly right, and I think that it speaks to what we call the flattening of the technological curve, that as you get more and more intensity of health services and more technology, outcomes generally get better until you reach a certain point. There's a point where there's probably too many health services actually start causing harm. And certainly the story regarding cesarean delivery is about that, that if you have a C-section rate less than, you know, 4 or 5%, that you have worse outcomes, both mothers and babies. But somewhere between 10 and 20%, and we really don't know exactly where that threshold is, when you start going above that point, you don't really see better outcomes for either mothers or babies. And as you go up and as you look into the future, you start getting worse outcomes for the mothers, there's no question.
So do we need, first of all, to change clinical practice with respect to C-sections? Wouldn't that reduce the problem?
We believe that if we could just embrace very simple approaches to the management of pregnant women in labor, that we could reduce the cesarean delivery rate, quite readily back down to the 20s at least, and that should have some impact on the maternal mortality rate. Again, I think I would caution us to be careful about pointing fingers at one cause. As Elliot has pointed out, it's multifactorial, and so it's not going to solve the entire problem, but it's certainly a piece of the problem.
Can you also talk, Aaron Coy, a bit about the kind of effect we're talking about vis-a-vis the impact that this has on families? I mean, it's death, but it has to be seen in that perspective of family by family, I think, does it not? Because the numbers seem small in comparison to the numbers of people who come through just fine.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, if you were going to put all your money from a public health standpoint into reducing overall population mortality, you would probably not allocate a huge amount of money to this one question if you were just looking at deaths. But when you think that these are essentially young, many of them young, healthy women whose, only risk factor is maybe a prior cesarean delivery oftentimes, the impact on the partner, the children is enormous. I mean, it's really a death before its time as opposed to, say, someone who passes in their 60s, 70s because of a heart attack, which is, they felt like they've had an entire life. And the way we kind of quantitated that is quality adjusted life years or life expectancy. And then when you consider it from that framework, the impact is actually larger than just the number of deaths itself.
So, Elliot Main, go ahead.
I would echo that in that each of these is an individual tragedy, not only for the person and her family, but actually for all the people who provide the care. These are generally catastrophic events that can destroy the whole healthcare team. We've been very sensitive to that as we review the cases. No one ever wants to be part of these cases, and physicians around the state have been very attentive as we've talked around these issues. Over the last couple of years, we've actually introduced a number of projects through the state health department to address severe hemorrhage, early labor inductions, and a variety of issues that may be contributory, and those are ongoing projects.
Can you mention anything else at this point that really needs to be focused upon in terms of insuring against this trend? Dr. Main?
Well, the two biggies, as I said at the beginning, are obstetric hemorrhage. Mothers still bleed to death in the U.S. and in California, and that should not happen. And there are a variety of state projects collaboratives that we've established that are working to address that. And the prevention of blood clots, both at the time of surgery and for folks who are at prolonged bed rest. Those are two interventions that are straightforward. The cardiovascular health disease, underlying cardiac disorders, as I mentioned before, is a new one and one that needs a lot of attention.
Nate Johnson.
The other point I'd like to make, though, is these are small numbers, granted, but there is an association between the mortality and severe morbidity. There's a lot more mothers who need blood transfusions and ICU admissions. That is sort of reflected by the proverbial tip of the iceberg of a mortality. And that's really what we're after, is trying to reduce the mortalities, but also the significant complications of childbirth.
And Nate Johnson, you want to say something?
Yeah, it's easy to, when we're talking about this in terms of morbidities and mortalities and using all of these medical words and talking about numbers, to forget how much of a real personal impact this is. And this was a really painful story to report in some ways, because I was talking with, I was going and trying to find people who had gone through this experience, survivors of families. And so many of these people just couldn't talk about it, even if they wanted to share, calling that number and saying, this is a really hard phone call for me to make, but I'm a reporter, I'm working on this story, and I want to talk about Susan, and just hearing that silence on the other end of the line.
Wow.
And then talking to all these women, I talked to a lot of women who hadn't passed away, but who had lost their uterus or who had a lot of trauma during birth. And, I just had a lot of conversations where people were in tears on the other end of the line. And it does make a big impact. And there's a lot of people that get hurt who don't die. So the canary in the coal mine thing is really important in this issue.
It's also important, I think, to point out that though there's a trend and the numbers are disturbing in every sense, it's more concentrated in rural areas, isn't it?
It's a little early to tell.
Is it too early to tell, Dr. Coy? Yeah.
Again, I would say that, that possibly that may be true. Again, it's I think that you really have to drill down and really figure this out. But the reason that that might be true is, again, that a smaller rural hospital may not have the resources to deal with these kind of severe obstetric hemorrhages. And part of the task force that Elliot has put together and is leading is really to help more smaller regional hospitals establish the resources to deal with major obstetric hemorrhage.
Elliot Bain, you want to comment on that?
Sure. From our data so far, I wouldn't really point the finger at small rural hospitals. We've seen deaths at university hospitals, at major level 3 hospitals, private hospitals, HMO hospitals, medium and small hospitals. It can happen across the board.
Could you, I know there are a lot of young women listening and families that have women who are pregnant. Just give some words of serious advice here in terms particularly of those who might be contemplating, for convenience sake, an earlier cesarean to avoid the labor or whatever. Dr. Main?
Well, that's certainly not a good reason to have significant surgery. You should really only do surgery if you have a real indication for it. And I would also counsel you to try and avoid practices that can lead to the development of an indication for cesarean. That's a long way around of saying that you shouldn't go to labor and delivery if you're in latent phase, other than be checked. Laboring at home, early labor is a great spot. Things happen when you go to the hospital and get put into a bed and so forth, that the farther you can get in labor before you show up, the better. I think you need to really pay attention to your health status, really watching how much weight you gain in a pregnancy, being careful to care for any underlying conditions. So it's a lot about taking care of yourself and not getting unneeded interventions.
Does any of the data point to anything that could be extrapolated with respect to home births?
Home births are a very tiny proportion of births in California, less than 1%. And it's very hard to get data because the complications from home births happen in hospitals. We try to track that with a checkbox in the birth certificate about intended place of birth. But it's, things can happen anywhere. There's certainly not a lot of additional stuff happening at home births regarding maternal mortality.
However. Nate Johnson.
Well, it's just interesting that the reason I got interested in this in the beginning is I'm working on research for a book about sort of the natural versus the technical. And I was born at home in Berkeley, and my mother, my parents thought this would produce this spiritually superior indigo child or whatnot. I'm living proof that there's no truth to that. And
respect that humility.
And then she had a postpartum hemorrhage, and the doctor had to rush over, and he had to flip a coin to decide, should he take her to the hospital or not. So the interesting thing here is that people from both sides are now saying low-tech, high-touch births.
Let me give out the phone number. Feel free to join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls. Again, toll-free, you can join us now, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. An unpublished state-sponsored study indicates that the rate of women in California who die due to causes related to pregnancy has actually tripled over a 10-year period from 1996 to 2006. Doctors are divided about the reasons for the apparent increase. We're discussing the study and its potential impact. And with us is Dr. Elliot Main, Chief of Obstetrics and Gynecology of the California Pacific Medical Center and Principal Investigator for the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. And with us also is Dr. Aaron Coy, who is Associate Professor at UCSF and directs the Center for Clinical and Policy Perinatal Research within the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He's with us from Chicago. And Nathaniel Johnson here in studio is a freelance journalist who wrote the article for California Watch on the recent study that suggests that maternal death rates have gone up considerably and should be a great cause of concern. I should also mention that you can hear more about pregnancy-related deaths in a report by Nate Johnson, which will be airing this Friday afternoon on the California Report magazine. And let's go right to your phone calls, and we'll begin with Anika. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I have a question because I've given birth in the Netherlands in a very different birthing culture. And I actually did end up having a C-section indicated because of a breech delivery for my first child, but I was VBAC for the second. And they very much promote women going for vaginal birth post C-section. And I'm wondering if how that's viewed here and what approach is taken in California and or the U.S. on the VBAC issue.
An important question. And Elliot Main, if you would.
Sure. You were an ideal candidate, someone who had a C-section for a non-recurring indication to have a VBAC. We did a lot of VBACs in the United States a decade ago. There were a small number of uterine ruptures, and that scared a number of hospitals and physicians away. Uterine rupture can be catastrophic. It's about 0.5%. So now we're faced with the sad state of many hospitals not even offering a VBAC. Bigger hospitals such as Dr. Coey's and mine certainly do. We have great success with VBAC, 80% success rates. But a smaller number of women are choosing to do that, either with or without the encouragement of their physicians, because it's easier to schedule. And the trouble with that is then you start adding up the number of cesareans. As Dr. Coy mentioned in the first hour, it's your second, third, and fourth C-section is where the risk really gets higher, not so much your first.
So physicians would presumably be attentive to that statistical measure and make their patients highly attentive to it, would they not?
Well, I think this is really the focus of the report and our ongoing efforts is to bring an understanding to both physicians and women that multiple C-sections aren't a good thing, and there ought to be some second thoughts about it.
Nate Johnson, the caller mentioned giving birth in the Netherlands. What do we know about foreign mothers as opposed to American mothers in these mortality childbirth terms?
Well, we know that the U.S. doesn't do very well in the international rankings. We're down around the bottom for developed countries, I think 43rd or 41st overall in the world. Some have called this the perinatal paradox, where we spend more money than anybody else on birth and yet do much, much worse in all kinds of different measures, maternal.
Well, this is Elliot Main again.
Yes.
And I was at a session here at our meetings in Chicago about maternal mortality yesterday, and one of the presenters was the head of the Confidential Inquiry of Maternal Deaths in Great Britain. They have very, very good 100% accuracy in their reporting, and they've seen a decline in maternal mortality as we've gone up. But she also cautioned about the foreign or the other many of the other countries' statistics. She showed slides of that it depends who you talk to in a country. If it's if it's a political leader, the maternal mortality rate is quite low. If you talk to frontline maternal child health people, the rates are 2 to 3 times or even more times higher than what gets officially reported to WHO. So a lot of these countries' statistics aren't at the same level as the United States or Great Britain, but nonetheless, we are higher than we should be. Great Britain would be the comparison that we would strive for.
And Aaron Coy, we've got a listener named Valentin who wonders if, he says just a thought to consider, what about the age of women giving birth during that decade under study? Generally, women are giving birth later in life, certainly than 10 years ago. And also, he writes, in vitro services, many women are doing everything possible to have a baby after years of unsuccessful pregnancies.
Well, that's right. There's no question that the demographics of women delivering in California and the United States have changed over the past 10 and 15 years. The rates of obesity have risen from about 15% to 25%. The rates of overweight and obesity together has broached 50%. The median age of women has increased. There's more multiple gestations because of in vitro fertilization. However, I will point out that despite all of those changes in demographics, the rate of cesarean delivery has gone up in every single one of those groups. And so while that may be a contributor to some of these outcomes, I think it's a little dangerous for us to simply rest on our laurels and think that's the entire cause.
I want to remind listeners, by the way, you can post comments or questions online just by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And we'll go to more of your calls. Scott, join us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Well, I have a question based on my experience, actually, at CPMC. About 10 years ago, I was pregnant with my first child, and my labor was late. So the doctor decided to induce me, and only after about 7 days. And when I went in to be induced, I was given a number of drugs. I think Pitocin is the number one drug to get you started. But then there was another drug that I was given as a cervix softener called, like, oxypentin or something. Does that sound familiar?
Maybe misoprostol?
It was probably misoprostol, which would be the drug most commonly used right now in the U.S. for cervical ripening.
It actually was one that started with an O. And when I looked up the drug subsequently, years later, because I had an awful experience, I had an allergic reaction to this drug. I went into severe labor and had to have a C-section where not everything went well. And I looked, and the drug is not, you know, had been related to deaths and to uterus tears, and had not ever been approved for giving birth. And so I'm just wondering, you know, how much of that is going on, and are you looking at, you know, real practices?
Well, you remember an oxy in here, and I think the doctors think another drug would have been advisable under the circumstances you described. But there's a broader question here about drug use, perhaps in some ways maybe drugs that I would imagine, particularly over at the California Pacific Medical Center, they're not using drugs that haven't been FDA approved. Dr. Main, you want to comment?
Well, one of the challenges we have in obstetrics is that very few drugs are FDA-approved for use in obstetrics. No drug company wants to do those studies. They're hugely expensive, and not many pregnant women want to be in drug trials. So we have to do the best we can with studies that have been done in university settings and randomized trials that are done, but not by drug companies and not with the intent to get FDA approval. So, for example, there's no medications in the United States approved currently for the treatment of preterm labor by the FDA, though we have four or five drugs that we commonly use. Oxytocin is used for induction of labor, but many of the cervical ripeners have not been FDA approved. So it's a bit of a challenge. No one wants to spend the millions of dollars to do those studies.
Any guess of what might have happened in the case of our caller, Scott?
I will echo what Elliot said about cervical ripening agents, prostaglandins. Sorry, this is Aaron Coy again. These prostaglandins that we use for cervical ripening, we know actually reduce the risk of cesarean delivery when used appropriately. And it is true because no drug company has kind of bothered to get FDA approval because it's a long, lengthy, expensive process, and it's a political process. You know, we get this, there's this kind of press out there. And I will point out that this press is pushed a little bit by the anti-abortionists because some of these agents can also be used for termination of pregnancy. So that, you know, these medications, which we think are incredibly useful for helping women to achieve vaginal delivery, are getting some bad press.
Now, there certainly have been cases of death and uterine rupture when some of these medicines were used for VBACs, vaginal births after cesarean, when there's already a scar on the uterus. And that's where most of those reports come, and those should never be used in that setting.
Nate Johnson, you want to add?
Well, the dividing line often becomes technology. You know, is this technology good or is it bad? And I think Aaron Coy's point really speaks to this, that it's not the technology, it's the culture in which the technology is used. And if the doctors have the right skills and the right tools to use that technology, it will be beneficial.
Jody, join us. You're on forum. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call and addressing this really important topic. I'm a mother who recently had a vaginal non-intervention birth in a hospital in San Francisco. And I just wanted to share an important factor. I think that by not all means is it the most important factor, but it is something that contributes. And that is the overall lack of confidence, I think, that women and the medical community have in the female body. You know, I think it's important to remember this is what the female body was born to do. And I think sometimes there's this overall assumption that an intervention or medicine can somehow help push things along. And it's, as the last caller said, it's a very slippery slope. Once you start with one, it continues on. And I think it's really important to remember that the body was born to do this, and time is important. The suggestion that came through about waiting to labor at home as long as possible, I cannot recommend that highly enough for women that are trying to avoid a cystic C-section.
That's sound advice. I'm wondering, though, about your first point about lack of respect for, well, for the for women's bodies. Get a comment from either of our physicians on that?
Well, I think that Zarin Coy. I think that's well said. I think that the idea that pregnancy is a pathologic condition that needs medical intervention is very common, and we approach pregnancy with kind of the medical model. Now, for the you know, majority of the 20th century, that was a good thing. I mean, as Atul Gawande chronicled in a very nice article about the Apgar score and about pregnancy, you know, maternal mortality plummeted throughout the 20th century because of a lot of the technology that's been introduced, antibiotics, induction of labor, even things like oxytocin. But in the latter part of the 20th century, and I think the early part of this century, because of this lack of trust that a woman, you know, will deliver in her way, in her time, we've seen this, I think, you know, dramatic rise in cesarean delivery over the last 10 to 15 years, which I think is contributing to this problem we're talking about today about maternal mortality.
Let me go to, I'm sorry, to Dr. That, Bain, go ahead.
Elliot, I would add a little different slant on that, which is it's a lack, I like the concept that it's a lack of respect for your body and what it can do. But I think the other aspect is that we, in the 2000s, want control.
Yeah.
Both women and physicians are looking to control the timing, the place, et cetera. And that can lead you down that slippery slope when you say, okay, let's start things when they really aren't ready to be started, or let's have a birth on Monday rather than another day.
It's control, and one would have to add fear, really, as primary motivators in the context you're talking about, isn't it? Here's a listener, Anne Marie, who writes, one of the guests in his advice to pregnant women suggested laboring at home and waiting to arrive at the hospital as long as possible. For my first child, I was quite clueless about when I should go, even though I had been to childbirth education classes and had read many books about birthing. On a fluke, we hired a doula, and she turned out to be invaluable, guiding the birthing process to the vaginal non-medicated birth I wanted. It seems to me that programs that provide doula care or even more education about doula service could help women take measures to avoid unnecessary interventions. Would either of our OBGYNs like to comment on doula care?
Sure, this is Aaron Clay.
A little hesitation,
you know,
maybe.
I think that actually, doulas who are not a medically trained person, but someone who's really been trained in birth and the process of birth, can be really invaluable to women. If you think historically, almost evolutionarily, you know, 10,000, 20,000 years ago, you would have witnessed and been part of a number of births before you experienced your own. And so women today, many have, you know, the first birth they're part of is their, other than the one that when they were born, which they oftentimes don't remember, is the one that they're taking part of as their first birth. And so having someone who can really be at the bedside and you know, throughout and kind of advise them is good. I think the problem with oftentimes the doula-physician relationship is that it's almost set up as a barrier, that the, instead of thinking of it as a team-provider approach...
It's adversarial?
That they can come at... Many times it can become adversarial, which is unfortunate. And so I think that, you know, on our side of things, on physicians and clinicians who take care of women in labor, you know, forming a relationship with the doulas from the start and, you know, from the beginning of pregnancy even could be really, really useful, I think, for women.
Let me go to a couple more listener emails. This is from Gail, who says, I live in Northern California. I delivered my first child vaginally and had a long 27-hour labor with 4.5 hours of pushing. After that long labor and all that pushing, when the placenta was delivered, not all of it came out. I ended up losing significant quantities of blood and had to have a DNC. I was severely anemic after this birth, and it took me a long time to recover. On the other hand, my second child was born C-section due to being breached. He had the cord wrapped around his neck, and there was no way to turn him. My C-section was planned. I had time to prepare mentally, and I found the C-section birth to be much less traumatic than the vaginal birth. While My recovery for the C-section also took overall physically less impacted than with the vaginal birth. So I just wanted to say the dangers to me with the vaginal birth were higher than with the C-section. Just want to get that on the record here. And here's another listener who writes, could all this have anything to do with advanced fertility techniques and the higher rate of multiple births?
I think absolutely. I mean, we've addressed that somewhat with looking at older women and the fact that the IVF fertility techniques are on the rise. But as I understand it, those numbers are very small when you look overall. I mean, it's in the media a lot, but the number of people out of all the people giving birth that are using those things, it's not very big.
That once again was Nathaniel Johnson, actually, who wrote the article on this for California Watch. How can people get access to that article, by the way?
Well, it's on. If you Google California Watch, it'll pop up. It's also in the Chronicle and several other newspapers.
I want to remind listeners what I said before, that Nate Johnson will have a report that will air this Friday on the California Report magazine and here on KQED Radio. Liesl is our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, I've been an OB nurse for 22 years. And I wanted to enlarge upon a couple of the last callers and have 3 points, please. The first being that over these 22 years that I've practiced in a couple of different places over the country, I've seen these trends, and they're very alarming to me. And the first deals with the responsibility that we as physicians and OB nurses have. Or maybe it's the hospital, since OB nurses are generally not asked about their opinions regarding hospital policies and procedures. And the trend that I see is a huge, huge increase in over-management, and that's the actual term that's used in labor and delivery, is the management of the birth. I've seen a huge increase in artificial rupture of membranes, wanting to get people in and out quickly. And then subsequently, as we're seeing over-medicalized, over-management of women in labor, we are also, as OB nurses, seeing a decrease in our staffing. Thank goodness, finally, a few years ago, California now has state-mandated nursing ratios. I think that was a huge improvement, but it's only a start. And, of course, it's not a national It is not a national requirement for labor and delivery or any kind of maternity nursing. And then thirdly, it is something that's deeply troubling to me as a professional and then also as a woman and a mother, and that's that I see more and more women coming into labor and delivery and wanting quickly to hand over their experience to the obstetrician. They come in terrified of birth. They have not received much childbirth education anymore. There was an increase in the 60s and 70s. I see that going away. What I see is women coming in asking for an epidural, wanting to hand everything over to the hospital, to the doctors, and even, of course, the current controversy of primary elective C-sections.
This is what you're describing, Liesl, almost sounds like retro movement backward, because certainly I remember
absolutely
the time when there was much childbirth coaching and much Laboye methods.
The same thing with breastfeeding. Yeah. Yes, and the same thing with breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. I'm also an international board-certified lactation consultant. And while at sometimes there is an improvement, there are things that are good. Again, I see more and more women saying, oh, just give them a bottle. I want to sleep.
Let me get a comment from Dr. Main on this as we approach our pledge drive. Dr. Elliott Main?
Well, as Dr. Coy said earlier, I think we have over-medicalized childbirth to a certain degree, and the pendulum needs to swing back. I do feel that you can't be over-prepared for childbirth, and I think that is an opportunity here. You know, and it goes to show that not everything is under hospital physician control, that we have to work with our culture to change our views of childbirth and not have both the demands and the willingness to accede to or for physicians to move in that direction. So both are needed here. I'd like to point out another website that that your readers could and listeners could go to, which is our website that has had these statistics posted for the last year or so, which is cmqcc.org, California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. So it's cmqcc.org. And there's a lot of – it's largely oriented for professionals, but there's a lot of good information. And if you want more detail in the maternal mortality stats, they've been there.
Did you want to add anything, Dr. Coy?
Just in terms of what Liesl said, I think it's important to validate that I will say that at my institution at UCSF, actually our labor and delivery nurses are intimately involved with creating hospital policy and the care of our pregnant patients. And I assume that is true at California Pacific Medical mm-hmm. Center as well. And that she's spot on, that it's about culture. It's about the fear perspective that I think an earlier caller talked about, that it's just much easier to kind of give up control and schedule in these days. And we have to kind of, you know, caution ourselves to think about it. And then, again, in terms of getting that experience, one of the things that we think can enhance the experience of going into labor and having a sense of it is something called centering pregnancy, which is group prenatal care, which allows women to hear other people's stories and have other people's questions asked and answered in front of them, so they have at least a little more sense. As Elliot said, you can't be too prepared.
You're listening to Forum, and this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Stephanie. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. Dr. Coy delivered my baby. Thank you, Dr. Coy. I actually am a nurse, and I had chosen a home birth. I'm one of those informed people who felt that home birth and natural vaginal birth was a safer option, but because of some complications, had to end up transferring after several days of laboring at home to UCSF. And I just felt that with Dr. Coy, he made a comment about easier interventions. And through working with Dr. Coy and the staff at UCSF, we tried multiple things over several days. They allow me to labor for up to 3 days, I think, before actually having an assisted vaginal birth, which was, for me, a great outcome because the baby was safe and I was safe. But I wonder if allowing women to labor for longer in the hospital and working with them instead of having a rush to have a C-section, is there a financial gain of having a quicker C-section versus allowing women to kind of labor for longer and working with them to have a vaginal outcome, a good outcome?
Yeah,
thanks, Dr. Coy.
I wanted to just add something to that because I'm looking at some emails here, and one of them says, in Europe, the post-delivery hospitalization is much longer than the 48 hours or less in the United States, and maybe longer clinical monitoring would improve the overall outcome, one of our listeners says. But caller raises some important questions. Dr. Coy, you want to respond?
Well, that's very kind of her to remember that experience. It was I remember it as well. And it does speak to how pregnancy and pregnancy care is reimbursed by the insurance industry. You know, pregnancy care is generally bundled. So you're given one reimbursement for almost the entire prenatal course and the delivery. And so there's no incentives to be patient. And basically hospitals and doctors actually lose a lot of money doing exactly what we did with Stephanie, being patient, being cautiously, you know, optimistic that things would, you know, as long as they made small progress, that was better than no progress at all. And, you know, we make the same amount if we had done the C-section the moment you showed. We'd actually make a little bit more if we'd done the C-section when you'd just shown up. Than we did with all the, you know, kind of nursing hours and whatnot. So there is a problem with the way that pregnancy care is incentivized financially. I can't really change that, overnight. But what I can do is you know, teach my residents and educate the people that I work with that, you know, to trust women, trust women's bodies, be patient, you know, and to trust that, you know, in the vast majority of cases, vaginal delivery can be achieved.
And Naomi, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting.
Hi there, Michael, and hi, Dr. Coy. You also delivered my first daughter. I had placenta previa, and I had a scheduled cesarean. And then for my second daughter with UCSF, they attempted for VBAC with me for 56 hours, and I really thank them for that. I know there's a couple of residents who were really anxious for me to deliver sooner, but I have a question. There does if I knew the statistics now, what I knew then, or if I knew then what I know now, it's very disturbing to know the rate of mortality. And I'm wondering, cardiovascular disease runs in my family, and I'm wondering, as a woman who's had two cesareans, is there any link to more of a risk of this type of disease later in life because of cesareans, or is there completely no relation if any research has been made?
I think the risk would be if you're going in for a third cesarean and you have that underlying cardiovascular risk, there might be an elevated risk. But as far as the other way around, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you have anything to worry about.
That's correct. There's no association. No, I think what Dr. Main was speaking to earlier is that someone who does have an underlying mild cardiac condition that, you know, when they're not pregnant wouldn't have any symptoms, then pregnancy, because of the changes in physiology, induce a more morbid condition, and that can lead to higher rates of mortality.
I want to conclude here with a question from a listener, Sheila, who says, when the story was published in the SF Gate yesterday, a flurry of angry and misinformed comments immediately followed. This is obviously a self-selecting group of people online, but I think it represents the vast amount of misinformation about birth on all sides of the discussion, from those supporting home birth because they think all doctors are schmucks to those that are strong believers in technology. What can be done to decrease our reliance on anecdotal stories and increase our knowledge of the facts and that there are options? This is from Sheila. Quick response, Nate Johnson.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is sort of the human condition in our century right now. You know, for all our advances in technology, the world is still a mysterious and unpredictable place. And rather than just turning to technology or just turning to nature, we should turn to culture and look to culture to solve these problems.
And learn the facts. And thank you all for providing many of those this hour. I want to thank Nathaniel Johnson from California Watch. His article is in there. Freelance journalist. You can hear him Friday on the California Report. And Dr. Elliot Main, chief of OBGYN at the California Pacific Medical Center, who is principal investigator for the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. And Dr. Aaron Coy, associate professor at UCSF and director of the Center for Clinical and Policy Perinatal Research in the Department of OBGYN. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.